wrestling podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace, which is an all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And for a free trial and 10% off, all you have to do is go to squarespace.com and use the offer code CALLEN8. You know, I always say I won't accept any sponsors that I don't believe in or that I don't use myself. I don't use Squarespace, but my friend does. And I actually watched him create a bunch of really good websites in, you know, I think he created like five of them in an hour. It was unbelievable. And they looked incredibly professional. And I'll tell you, if you're not as, and he's pretty savvy when it comes to, you know, computers and stuff. But if you're not that savvy, the great thing is they have an incredibly easy to use support team. You can get them anytime, 24/7, and they're always there to help. And it just, it's $8 a month, which includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And it really, they really actually have, I looked at it, they actually have some really cool features and these new designs, and it's really just these incredible style options. And it really allows you to create a very unique website. So I have to say that I am happy that they're sponsoring this, because I actually believe in the product. I think it's excellent, and it's a good example of how technology is making it easier for the everyday layman like myself to have an experience that reaches a lot of people and make it look very professional. And Squarespace is very good at that. So if you want a great website and that's very easy to create and costs virtually no money, go to squarespace.com. And if you type in the offer code CALLEN8, you'll get 10% off. Do it! Don't be cheap! All right, everybody, welcome to the Brian Callen Show. I'm here with my partner in crime, Hunter Motz, and Hunter once again has got us somebody whose pedigree is not worthy of the. I'm not worthy of this guy's pedigree. He's an attorney, and on the side decides to write really obscure history books like Firearms: A Global History to 1700, which, by the way, is a great book. And before I introduce you, Ken Chase, I've got to just read what William McNeil, whose books I've read, and a hell of a historian himself, said about you. Kenneth Chase's book is indeed a delight and a great achievement. His central claim is that each of the major agrarian governments of Eurasia used gunpowder weapons in a rational way, and that difference depended on geographical circumstances, not on cultural traditions or soldiers' stubborn affection for horses. The breadth of information and the precision of his interpretation are exhilarating. Chase unites extraordinary learning with even more extraordinary wisdom and presents them to us in an easy, graceful prose. Wow. I'm sorry, man, but to get a review like that from Kenneth Chase, I mean, from William McNeil, and by the way, you're a lawyer. I mean, you're a corporate lawyer, and you're able to write books that people who are, like, renowned historians give that kind of review to. That's got to feel pretty good.
I was pretty blown away by that blurb as well, actually.
Yeah.
Very happy to see it, yeah.
Well, you know, I had read, before I read your book, I read Guns, Germs, and Steel. And it felt like a really nice companion piece to that book. You explore something that maybe most of us don't know to ask, but a lot of us have those questions. Why? Gunpowder and really guns were invented in China. The Europeans perfected them. And you kind of explore why that is. I thought your whole description of what it's like on the Tartar steppes or whatever, is that what it's called, in the Gobi Desert and stuff?
The grasslands, yeah.
Why guns and why? I learned so much about warfare and the logistics, which is everything in warfare, like supplies. I never think of that stuff. I just think of a horse and weaponry. But you got to bring food for your horses. You got to bring water. You got to bring everything. And I never thought about that. So maybe you could anyway. Welcome to the Brian Callen Show. what a crappy intro. I didn't even ask you a question, man.
No, thanks a lot. It's the logistics angle. I think in military history over the last 20 years or so, people have really been focusing on that a lot, and it's a practical thing that generals in the past and generals in the present had to deal with all the time. It was always in the front of their mind, and if we look at the past and we don't keep that in our own minds, there's a lot of stuff that won't make sense that made sense to them back then.
Well, Ken, let me ask you, let's start with a broad-based question. You're an attorney. Why history? A lot of the people that listen to my show are young people. I notice a lot of young people don't have a command of history, and I was a history major in college, so I always talk about how important it is. But what got you to write this book? Why is this book important to you, and why history in general?
Okay. I got interested in this book. I studied Chinese as an undergraduate, and then I went to graduate school to do Chinese history. I think history is, it's really a way that we understand, it's a basic mode for people to understand things. So even when something happens in your own life, you look back on it and you think, you know, why did this happen? What did I do to make it happen? What could I have done to avoid it? And I think history is sort of a way of looking at that, of looking at things, but sort of directed at more than just yourself, but at your whole society, your country, or even the whole world.
That's interesting, because I've heard history described by a historian as the study of conflict and the study of surprises. And this is for sure a study of conflict. You've really got to, it's almost as though, tell me if this is true, you could study the history of warfare and get a pretty good and strong notion of what happened in the past. I mean, you could start there, and it's a pretty good place to branch from.
And a pretty interesting place to branch from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just from kind of the technology and what, you know, the movements of peoples and the ripple effect therein, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's how I get interested in history when I was a teenager. I think like a lot of guys, just reading about World War II. And, you know, one of the funniest things I've seen when I've been traveling in China recently, because I go to a lot of bookstores there, now they have a World War II section as well. And it's not about China fighting Japan. It's all about German tanks.
Wow.
There's something in, like, you know, a guy's DNA or something that just is like, we want to read about German tanks during World War II, even if we're like Chinese.
You know what, man? You just hit you, because you describe in your book kind of what the kind of weaponry we have now, and how where we've come in perfecting just guns. Not forget bombs and rockets. I mean, there's one section where you talk about guns. There's a gun, an MK-19 or something like that can shoot 18 miles. I mean, bullets like that has a range of something crazy, like 18 miles.
Yeah, the stuff they have today is incredible. Even the stuff they had 20 years ago was amazing. And that's part of the reason why it's so hard for people to understand medieval guns, because medieval guns were so bad.
Well, and I mean, that's what Brian's talking about with the logistics. The statistic that I loved is, you know, you were talking about, you need horses to carry the cannon. Then you need horses to carry the food for the horses that carry the cannon. And then you need horses to carry the food, and so on and so forth. And I think you said that you need 200 horses per gun or something like that, or per cannon.
Huge numbers. And that was in Europe during like the 1600s, 1700s.
Right. So
huge numbers of horses. And, you know, it took forever to drag those things around because you didn't have paved roads. Mm-hmm. Right? And then it took forever to set them up and fire them. Basically, this is, you know, one of the key sort of points in the book, and like the other key points, it's really obvious. If your target is moving, you're never going to have a chance to hit it. So move out of the way before you ever set these things up.
Yeah, especially when you're that slow and that unwieldy.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
William McNeil wrote a book called The Shape of European History, and it's not a big book, but it's he talks about how different innovations like the crossbow, like the stirrup, like certain knots for sailing, really had such a huge effect. Innovations that changed everything, gave the Mongols such an edge up on warfare, because they were able to aim with their stirrups. They could get up in their saddle and aim more accurately. Crossbow that rendered knighthood obsolete overnight, man. Give us some examples of technology that you think. When did guns? I was amazed, by the way, that guns had been around as long as you say they had. First of all, it's one of the things I learned from your book. But when did guns really change the landscape? When did things really change? When did guns become sort of a deciding factor, just undeniable? I guess is the word.
I think probably in Europe, you'd be looking at the late 1400s, early 1500s.
That early,
yeah. Because the existing fortifications at a certain point became completely obsolete. Because once you had a gun that worked well and shot on a low trajectory, it could knock over those high walls.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and
at that point, you had a complete redesign of all the fortifications in Europe in the early
15th. Well, in fact, the fall of Constantinople, I think in 1490 or something. In fact,
1453, yeah.
Yeah, they had a massive cannon. The Turks brought in a massive cannon, and it took them something like 100 days to actually longer than that, but they dragged it 100 miles, I think. And they broke those walls that had been standing for 1,000 years. And that must have been just surreal for everybody listening to the fall of essentially, you know, the last sort of stand of Christian civilization in that area.
And the end of the Roman Empire. I mean,
that's,
you know,
what it was.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I think that is fascinating is you're also working on a multi-volume book currently about the Mongols.
That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
And I think you said, how long is it going to take you?
well, I have 4-year-old twins and I have a job, so I'm aiming for 2024.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, that's what you want to be a historian. You want to be a father and a lawyer. That's what it takes. That's what it takes.
Guys, you're gonna have to wait a decade for this.
Why? I've read a couple books on the Mongols. Why the Mongols? Why, you seem to be. You know a lot. I mean, from your book, and then this book talks a lot about the Mongols. Why the Mongols? Why are you so interested?
Yeah, honestly, I was doing Chinese history during grad school, and didn't feel it was really enough of a challenge. Mm. And looking at ways of combining it with sort of other fields.
That's when you know he's smart. He's like, you know what, Chinese history wasn't that challenging. You know that ancient civilization? Not that challenging. I need something else.
5,000 characters,
10,000 characters. You like to stay busy, brother. That's for sure.
So there's you know, I tried combining it with Japanese history, but for pre-modern history, the biggest overlap was Buddhism, which puts me to sleep. but then at a certain point, you know, I went to Japan to do some of my graduate research, and I met this professor there who was working on the Mongols. He had just arrived at the university when I got there, and he was fascinating. He knew, he was the smartest guy in the room, and he had the best observations, is because by studying the Mongols, you get to do not only Chinese history, not only some Japanese history, but history of the Middle East, history of Europe. You have to tie all this stuff together. And, you know, it's a challenge, but it's a lot of fun. You get to learn a lot of stuff. And to me, it was sort of it's the most difficult thing that I can do that I'd actually be good at doing. I mean, I can find things that I can't do, like dunk a basketball.
Right, right.
That, or run a 4-minute mile or something. But
right.
For me, this is the thing that would be the hardest to do that I can actually. So it's the way I can challenge myself the best.
Well, let's talk about the Mongols, because there's a lot of, you know, people, everybody likes to talk about Genghis Khan and stuff. My feeling is that this was a very energetic sociopath. I mean, is that right? I mean, what his vision was to unify the tribes of the Gobi Desert, and then he went off and basically tried to conquer the world.
And got pretty damn close.
But this guy was a sociopath. He's got to be in one of the lower rungs of hell right now, don't you think?
He's, you know, I put him together with people like Napoleon and Alexander the Great.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they were great generals. They're great conquerors. That doesn't make you a great person. Doesn't mean you're doing anyone any favors other than yourself, really.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not sure he belongs in with, you know, the Stalins and the Hitlers or something. So,
were the Mongols as brutal as you hear? I mean, I heard that they would. I mean, I know that you described the way they would hunt, which is that they would literally herd the animals into an area and close it off and wouldn't let anything escape, and then they'd finally slaughter all the animals. I've heard that that's what they would drive everything into one area and then come in and slaughter the whole village. And if Genghis Khan was really mad at you, he would divert a river over where you used to be. Is that true?
I haven't heard the diverting the river part, but they were completely fearsome and savage and brutal. And, you know, my kind of position, first of all, as a historian, it's not really, you know, I mean, what I think is I'll put out the facts and you can make your own mind up about what you think about these people. And I certainly wouldn't have enjoyed hanging around with them or anything. But my position on this is basically, people are really brutal.
Yeah. The more you learn about history, all peoples, I mean, look at the French Revolution and the atrocities committed in the name mm-hmm. of the revolution. Look at Germany, a group of people that read Goethe and, you know, were supposedly the most civilized people in the world. Look what they did to not just the Jews, but so many other people from 39 to 41, for 45, etc. Yeah, you history. Look at Rwanda. My God, look at the Balkans War. Yeah. It just keeps going, man.
What happens with the Mongols is, you know, they didn't write about themselves. They didn't write that much, period. So they didn't write that much about themselves. Most of what we have about them is written by other people.
Yeah.
And it's mm-hmm. a lot easier to talk about other people's atrocities than it is to talk about your own.
Right. And I think the other interesting thing, too, is, of course, is that one of the consequences of this vast empire was the Pax Mongolica. Right, they were able to establish this period of peace pretty much throughout the world and reopen a lot of the trade networks.
Yeah, I mean, the knock-on effects were tremendous and really interesting and very, very far-reaching.
Well, wouldn't he send an emissary sort of ahead of him and say, do you surrender? It's kind of like Alexander the Great, but do you surrender or do you choose to fight? It wasn't that kind of the alternative, the ultimatum he would give to the villages and the towns he was coming upon?
Yeah, no, their basic philosophy, they divided the world into two groups, basically people in obedience and people in rebellion. And people in rebellion.
So not big worshippers of John Locke. Yeah, they didn't read a lot of John Locke and David Hume.
Brian has a similar philosophy on attractive women.
That's exactly right. And there are Brian Callen fans, and then there are
people in rebellion.
And there are people in rebellion who still haven't accepted that I'm going to take over the world.
No, so when he got the first emissary came from the Pope, right? He sent a message back saying, tell him to come out here to Mongolia and bow to us, right?
Wow.
Awesome.
King of France, Louis IX, got in touch with him and got a message back saying, you know, come on out here. And, you know.
Yeah, that's a lot of guys. I wouldn't do that. I'd have to be like, you know what, I'm not going all the way to Mongolia, especially on horseback.
But people did. I mean, the king of Armenia did, for example.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right?
I would imagine.
But the Russian dukes did.
Wow.
Yeah. The other thing that's fascinating, too, is one of the great facts that you have in your book Firearms is that you talk about how, you know, Mongol warriors could go out on the field with basically no food and that they would just live by drinking the blood of their horses.
That's fucking awesome. It's like Avatar. Yeah. But
so
not really.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that the European travelers noticed, especially the first few who went out there, these guys were Franciscan friars, you know, they'd taken vows of poverty, and they were just amazed at how little food they got. They kept talking about how hungry they were all the time and how little the Mongols ate, and the stuff that they ate was just so disgusting. They're eating, you know, lice and mice and the afterbirth from, you know, horses, and
wow,
just, they ate everything.
Whatever they could get.
And then and not that much of it either, right? I mean, you know,
yeah.
The food is bad, and even worse, the portions are so small.
Yeah. Were they very small people? Hard to say.
Hard to say, really.
Yeah. Yeah. They weren't vegan, let's put it that way.
They drank a lot of milk, actually, horse milk, especially during the summertime.
Right.
After the mares had given birth during the spring, and they fermented as much of it as they could, and they get drunk all the time, and the rest of the time they're drinking. So they had a very, very liquid kind of dairy kind of diet.
Well, you know, the Maasai Mara, the Maasai of Kenya and Tanzania, they are primarily, they live off their animals. They live off the blood of their animals, and they drink a lot of milk, they'll drink 7 quarts of milk a day if they can. So they have a liquid diet, too. And by the way, the Maasai are some big people.
Yeah, and tough.
And strong.
Yeah.
So, you know, who knows? You know, they had to have been pretty tough and strong. But, I mean, because they were such legendary warriors.
Yeah. No, they were tough as nails. They were. And, you know, I think living off the animals explains another part of sort of the Mongol way of thinking, which is that, you know, they sort of divided the world between animals that lived off the land and then people that lived off the animals, right? But animals that lived off the land also included, like, peasants in other countries and stuff like that.
Wow.
They put them on a level with, like, their own cattle and horses and stuff.
What kind of religion did the Mongols have? Were they pagans? I mean, what did they pray to?
They believed, you know, they worshipped the sky god originally. And and I've, that explained is when you're out there on the steppe, the sky looks really big.
Yeah.
And, you know, hailstorms and snow comes down from there and stuff like that. So it's kind of a, you know, straightforward kind of religion. But they were very, very, very practical. And, you know, whenever they, you know, sacked and burned and destroyed other civilizations and stuff, the people they were really interested in were religious practitioners and skilled craftsmen. And they would give, you know, tax breaks to the priests or the, you know, those types in each place. And I think they just figured, you know, the more people praying for us, the better. And, you know, who knows which one works? And, you know, maybe they all work in different ways. And so let's, you know, we'll get something good out of it. And so they were very open-minded in that sense.
Well, one of the things that I heard, that one of the challenges Genghis Khan faced was that when he was doing all this raiding and marauding and all that, and they would bring the younger boys with them so that they could kind of learn on the job and kind of they'd hang back and watch. And one of the problems that he had was that the boys started raping and stealing from their own clans. And so Genghis Khan had this, you know, when he said to them, look, you can do that to those people over there, but not to us. That didn't fly. That wasn't a philosophy that was going to last or have any kind of traction to it. So he had to really confront the immoral behavior he was fostering among his own group, because it was becoming a snake eating its own tail. I don't know if you have you ever heard about that or read about that? Something I read about a long time ago.
I think, you know, there's a long sort of the reason that the Mongols weren't as powerful originally was precisely because they spent all their time fighting against each other like that. Mm. And, you know, his achievement somehow was to get them to focus all that energy outside rather than against each other.
Which is always that's the same thing Muhammad did. His great problem was that the Arab tribes were all fighting each other, right, and he needed to find a way to unify
under
them.
Under the banner
of
Islam.
Yeah.
What right. I was thinking
and
about
what happened when he did that, how far they spread and how quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the other example in history, really, that's as close as possible to the Mongols.
Yeah, and
they stopped fighting each other and they combined and they could just do amazing things.
Well, and that was there's a famous Arab historian, Ibn Khaldun, right, who talks about essentially like his whole thesis was about what he called asabiyya, which is right. Basically the glue that binds a society together. And he said that the society with the stronger asabiyya, the stronger glue, would ultimately win over the society with the weaker glue, right? And the Mongols had this incredibly strong glue, and then, you know, the Arabs achieved that for the duration of the caliphate.
Yeah.
Did they share the same language across the Gobi Desert? Were they ethnically the same, racially the same?
They were similar. They were both Turks and Mongols, and the two languages are related, but they're not really close to each other that you can just speak one and the other person will understand you necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of religion, actually, one of the interesting things is there were quite a few Christians on the Mongol steppe during this period. And
really?
Because the Eastern Christianity had actually spread out as far as Mongolia, even into China, although it may have very little traction in China. But, you know, you read about people who are contemporaries that Genghis was fighting against, and they have names that are turn out to be the Turkish version of, like, George or Mark or something like that.
Wow.
Typical Christian names, yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
But can you talk to us about Kublai Khan? Was Kublai Khan Genghis Khan's son?
He was his grandson. Genghis Khan had four sons.
Okay.
And he was...
Well, he had four legitimate sons. I mean, isn't there some crazy statistic about, like, something like 5% of the world's population has Genghis Khan's DNA in their blood?
Gee whiz.
Yeah.
He didn't do all that by himself, though. I think part of that. You're absolutely right. He had, but, you know, his sons had lots of sons and so forth. Yeah. But, he had... The four were sort of the ones by his legitimate wife. And, you know, the second one of those... succeeded him, and then one of his sons succeeded him, and then it shifted over after a kind of coup d'etat to the fourth son. Although the fourth son was already dead at that point, and so then it was the sons of the fourth son who really started running the empire, and Kublai Khan was one of those.
What happened to the Mongol Empire? It fell apart about in the 1400s, didn't it? Russia and China rebelled against it about then, didn't they?
There were sort of two phases, really. One was, you can date it sort of from around 1206, which is when Genghis finally unified the Mongolia. In 12 by 1260, they had taken over sort of northern China, Russia, big parts of the Middle East, and so forth. At that point, there was a succession crisis, and the different parts of the empire became fairly autonomous. And when Kublai Khan was ruling the China part of it, he was still recognized by most of the other parts as being the supreme leader. Mm-hmm. But in for practical purposes, he didn't really exert control over the things that happened inside other people's parts. So you can treat that, if you want to, as being the fall of the empire, and some people do. On the other hand, you know, depends what you take as your standard, because there were periods during the Roman Empire when it was split between, you know, they had two emperors or four emperors at the same time, and they were sort of cooperating with each other. There's a senior and a junior one or whatever, so forth. So the other way to look at it is sort of, you can push it back to the 1300s and 1400s when different parts of that, you know, the Russians didn't really get free until the 1400s. Chinese broke free in, you know, the 1360s. And, you know, Iran, even a little bit earlier than that, perhaps. So each of the different parts, they're so far apart from each other. The empire was so big. They're just, communications were so slow. And it was just impossible to keep something that big together for that long.
Well, and it was, it seems like it was a strategic decision to split it up into three parts. The same thing with Alexander the Great, right? They basically realized the empire was too big to rule.
That's right, yeah.
Well, was Kublai Khan aware of Alexander the Great? I mean, was he even aware of his example, or is there any evidence of that?
Alexander the Great was a really well-known figure in Islamic civilization.
Right.
Where he goes under a slightly different name, and there were fables about him and stories about him that were all through Europe and all through the Middle East, but I don't think he was really known in the Far East, and so I'm not sure Kublai Khan would have been too aware of him. You know, what people would have thought of him were more these fantastic stories than the historical reality.
Well, what I mean specifically is that whenever you hear about Genghis Khan, there's this idea that, Alexander the Great, you always would hear that he would send an emissary in and say, just accept my rule and you can even keep your own rulers. We're not going to destroy everything. We're going to keep things intact. That was one of the secrets of why his influence was so far ranging.
Right. And that's something that the Mongols did as well. If you submitted right away, then they would keep the power structure largely intact.
I am hearing him.
Yeah, and one of the things that I remember reading about is that essentially once Kublai Khan was taking over China, what he realized is that he couldn't rely on the Chinese to run the empire, and so he basically brought in a lot of foreigners to run the empire for him.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And they used to call them the Light Eyes or something, because I guess they were probably Turkic peoples or...
Well, when they describe Genghis Khan, I've heard him described as having auburn hair and light-colored eyes. I've heard him described as looking more Afghani than he did Chinese or Mongolian, as we would think of it today.
Yeah, there are paintings that survive of him, but they're not necessarily good likenesses because of the sort of artistic philosophy back then was not necessarily to paint something the way that it looked. So, too sure.
Do we know if he was a tall man? Do we know much about him physically?
Not really. It's funny, when you read the secret history of the Mongols, it's the basic source for his life. It contains like 80-90%. They describe the color of the horse that he's riding.
Huh.
Or they don't describe the people that much, what they look like. And, you know, the best descriptions of what they look like come from the foreign travelers. Because, you know, when travelers go someplace, they notice all the stuff that people who live there kind of take for granted, right?
Well, and it's a question of different priorities, right? We're interested in what the person looks like. They're like, man, that guy has a great horse.
Well, you know, by the way, horses are indigenous to the Gobi Desert, to that area. Am I right? That's where they kind of originated, and then they branched from there. I think I'm right about that. I may not be.
I haven't gone that far back.
I think that's where horses. You know, I think that they were indigenous to that part of the world, and then they kind of spread. They were taken to different parts of, you know, the Fertile Crescent, and then finally to the New World and those places. But you know, horses didn't come to this country, the United States. You're calling us from Hong Kong, I should mention, but they didn't come to the United States until I think the Spanish brought them over. And the Spanish didn't get them. I think the Spanish may have gotten them from the Moors, from the Arabs, and the Arabs got them, I think, from the Mongols, from the Mongol invaders. That's the lineage, I think.
You know, horses were known a lot further back in history. It's hard to really ascribe them to any. But the Mongols, they definitely knew their horses. They lived with them. You know, they knew them inside and out. I mean, they ate them, and they were. It's funny though. They were very unsentimental about them though.
Yeah, you know, they were tools.
You don't read about like Genghis Khan's favorite war horse and what his name was and stuff like that, because he was like sucking its blood until it, you know, collapsed, and then it just jumped. Right?
That's so interesting. What amazing. A symbiotic relationship, right. Man. What a wild relationship. I wonder what horse blood tastes like when it's living off the grasses of the Gobi, of the, you know, the steppes.
Tastes like manhood.
Wasn't their you know, first choice of what to eat or something, but what made them so amazing was that just when they had to, they put out these incredible bursts of effort, and that's how they could do, one of the reasons they could do amazing stuff that just opposing generals were completely unprepared for, because all of a sudden they would move, you know, a much farther distance than any other army you'd ever encountered before could move, and they would do it over lands where, you know, there was no food, and you would figure no army could possibly move through this, and all of a sudden they'd appear someplace where you just weren't expecting them to be, and you thought they could never get to.
So, yeah, well, that's such ingenious stuff. You're on horseback and you're living off your horse. I mean, as long as there's grass, you're fine.
And the ability to coordinate over really, really large distances. I remember reading something about how that basically the Mongols were able to communicate between divisions, that, you know, one would be in southern Hungary and one would be on the German shore or whatever it was, and that was a level of military coordination that really wasn't seen until the invention of modern technology.
Yeah, it was amazing the way, over incredibly long distances, that they would just plan ahead. They were great in terms of reconnaissance and spying and going to places where they'd never been before. The invasion of Poland, yeah, it's a good example.
That's how they used to hunt, right? They would hunt that way. They'd send out some scouts, and then the whole tribe would converge on these animals and just run them down, essentially, into an area where they couldn't get away, and then slaughter them.
That's right. And the hunting was not only practiced for, you know, shooting your bow and riding your horse, but for all kinds of military maneuvers.
You know, I went, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. And so I think, you know, a lot of the cooperation on the battlefield was also a sort of tacit, even without communication, kind of tacit understanding of where the other guy was going to be. And if you think of something like, you know, sports like hockey or basketball, or even better say, you know, soccer, a lot of it is kind of, you know the other guy's, if you move forward, the other guy's going to move behind you to cover your back, or, you know, generally if I pass the ball in this direction, I know the guy's going to be, you know, over there because he's the right wing guy and I'm the left wing guy, and so forth.
Sure. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And for a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code CALLEN8. Well, you know, I got to tell you, I went hunting for deer in the Missouri Breaks, and I had a lot of gear on. I had a high-powered rifle, and just that experience alone of stalking and killing a deer over 4 or 5 days, I got a very, very clear sense of the skill set it would take to stalk and kill a human being. And I heard that, you know, Navy SEALs and Special Forces guys, they a lot of them were hunters. And if they weren't hunters, part of the training is to track and kill an elk or a deer, from what I understand. But it's a very similar skill set. But there's also something else you get from hunting. When you kill and then dress an animal, when you have to essentially butcher the animal and get into its viscera and get all that blood on you and the smell, it would make it much easier to kill a human being as you become more intimate with the process of killing an animal. I can see that. I could just feel it. On top of the fact that you're living such a carnivorous lifestyle, I don't think it's a mistake that so many of our fiercest sort of, you know, the stories of the fiercest cultures and the Afghanis and the Chechenis and they're usually mountain nomadic people. I mean, the Somalis. The Somalis are incredibly violent. They basically have a saying, I think, where if we don't have an enemy to fight, brother will fight. You know, so most of these cultures that are nomadic, that live off their animals, that are primarily carnivorous, they seem to be, throughout history, the fiercest and probably the most feared. Anyway, I don't know if I'm right.
Absolutely, I think that's right. I mean, you get that experience, that training, and you just get used to it, and that makes a huge difference.
Well, yeah. And I think it's the interesting thing is to contrast that with, say, the Spartans, right? And the Spartans were an agricultural people, but what they had to do is they had to suppress a group of people, have them grow their food so they could have the luxury of training all day. They had to set up training separately, whereas just being a Mongol was the greatest military training ever, like trying to live on the steppe.
Just being one,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, if you compare them to the elite soldiers in other societies at their time, there were people, you know, the Mamluks or the samurai who were also very elite. But with the Mongols, it was everyone straight across.
Yeah.
And one of the big tensions that you write about in your book is the difference between warfare between farmers as opposed to warfare between farmers and nomads, right? So essentially the point is that those early cannons make sense when you're France fighting a French city fighting a German city, because the German city can't run away. You can take your time dragging the cannon across the plains and then blow the shit out of it when you get there, whereas that doesn't work when you're fighting a nomadic enemy, right?
That's right. And even before you get to the city, you know, the other guy, if he wants to protect it, if he doesn't want to hide behind the walls, he has to stand out in front and fight. And he can't just move off, because then you move into his home and you take his cities and so forth. But with the Mongols, they could basically keep moving around till you ran out of food, you know, and there wasn't anything you could do to hurt them. If they didn't want to fight you, they wouldn't fight you.
Right.
And this really reminds me
That was the other thing that where they could just kind of like, or give chase until you ran out of supplies. And then he'd be like, guess what, dude? We're sucking on our horses. Ah! Water must have been such a... I mean, they probably hydrated that way as well, right? They didn't need as much water.
I heard Good Humor is actually bringing out a horse blood popsicle this summer season.
Yeah, the frozen blood truck is here, everybody. They were vampires.
Horse vampires.
I mean, you can't carry that much food around with you, especially if you don't have sort of modern concentrated kind of, you know, energy bars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We're talking about days. You know, we're talking about, I think, you know, 10 days rations is about the maximum that you can carry around, you know, in addition to all your other equipment and everything like that.
It doesn't feel like things have changed that much in modern times, really. I mean, you still have to pack your own water a lot of times. You can have MREs, but... There is a limit to what a human being can pack. I mean, you have vehicles and stuff, but if you're in the mountains, the Kush of the Kush or something, you're relying on helicopters if they can get there and provide their own storms. So I was thinking about how if you had an army that had to cross the desert, they'd be faced with a lot of the similar logistical issues.
Oh yeah, if you had to carry your water with you,
yeah.
You know, and you were sweating like a madman in the middle of the desert, we're talking like 2 days, right? You basically, you can get 1 day away from a river, and then you better walk back in the other direction pretty fast.
Well, I lived in Saudi Arabia when I was a kid, and I remember that there was this saying, you 12 hours, you're down. 12 hours without water in Riyadh or in Jeddah in the desert, you're going to die. You're down. You go down. You know, you get so dehydrated so quickly. I mean, we are a water-based operation, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Much faster than
absolutely. A lot faster.
Another one of the, you know, another thing that's sort of pretty uniform across military history is the rate at which people can march. Infantry units, starting with the Romans, we're talking, you know, the 19th century, basically, you know, 12 miles a day, you know, give or take a couple miles. And that's the standard movement rate for almost all armies throughout history.
Really? 12 miles a day.
So how did the Mongols compare to that?
You have to break camp, and you've got to like get the guys in formation and move them out, and then you've got to entrench at the end of the day and all that. You know, as an individual, you can walk a lot farther, but you look at the only army that really broke this was the Zulus.
Really?
And, yeah, they were sort of like, you know, the Mongols of the infantry, because they were moving 20, 30 miles a day.
How would they do that?
I don't know.
God.
But,
What were they, running?
I mean, other than that,
yeah, they used to
else
run
at the same rate, but those guys were just like buzzing all over.
Damn.
But,
so how fast would the Mongols move compared to that 12 miles per day?
You know, it would depend sort of what mode they were in, because if they were moving sort of long range and they had to bring their flocks with them, like, you know, sheep will only move maybe 5 or 6 miles a day.
Uh-huh.
They'd actually be moving quite slowly. But once they would abandon, that does like a mobile supply base. When they abandoned that, right, then they could go 30, 40 miles a day, even more.
Wow.
That's amazing. Do we know anything about their, the diseases that they suffered from and things? Were they pretty disease-free?
I think they must have been pretty healthy, just living, you know, the way that they did. There's bubonic plague comes from these sort of rodents that live on the steppe, and which the Mongols ate, of course, like they did everything else they came across. And supposedly the Black Plague, you know, Black Death came to Europe via the Mongols, sort of towards the end of the empire during the 1300s. But the Mongols didn't seem to have suffered from it.
Yeah, they kind of brushed it off. They were like, oh, a little plague. You know, you never hear about the frail Mongols. You don't conquer the world. And you know, we're talking about them, what, 800, 900 years later. You know, they weren't that frail. Something tells me that they were pretty robust.
There are actually still a few deaths every year from bubonic plague in Mongolia, and it's because one of the things they still like to eat is marmot, which is basically this large rodent. And supposedly, what
delicious.
They do is they'll cut the marmot open, take some hot rocks, and then fill the marmot with hot rocks and sew it back up, and it'll just cook that way.
Delicious.
Yeah.
Delicious. Anybody
really
want
good.
Some marmot pie? By the way, you don't get bubonic plague from the actual rat. You get it from the flea that sits on the rat, from what I understand. And the flea bites you. So
right, yeah.
You see what you learn in the Brian Callen Show? You get a little genealogy or what is it?
And a cooking lesson.
Epigenealogy, yeah.
Wait till, you know, there's going to be a companion cookbook to my 12-volume history.
How
yeah,
to cook
exactly.
rat and horse placenta.
Right, exactly.
So that's the thing. I don't know how much you've thought this through. I mean, you've got at least another decade worth of reading before you can write this book. But, you know, to what extent do you think that the sort of general idea that we have of the Mongols as these fairly bloodthirsty people, do you think you're going to be challenging that and, you know?
No, I think that's pretty accurate.
I love it. I love it.
What I want to do, what I really want to do with this book is make it a fun story. This is going to be a narrative history. It's not going mm-hmm. to be kind of an academic sort of history, and it's going to be story after story of just, you know, wild and crazy stuff that happens, because it's so much reading the primary sources is so much fun.
Yeah,
and just so many crazy things. I don't know where to start. I mean, one of my favorite stories, like, you know, the Mongols, they went to, you know, the Caucasus Mountains, right? They conquered like the Georgians and people like that. And these guys, they were just, you know, viciously tough people as well, right? The Mongols loved them anyway. First, the Mongols kicked their ass, right? But then, like, you know, these guys showed up in, you know, like the retinue of various, you know, Mongol leaders. And that particular campaign had like two or three future emperors of the Mongol Empire on that, these princes. So, you know, 20 years later, right, one of these guys from the Caucasus is following one of the emperors, the Mongol emperor, down into China, and they see, you know, a tiger. And the emperor's like, hey, you ever seen one of those things before, right? So this guy jumps off his horse. He grabs the tiger by the tongue and kills it with his knife.
Oh, my God.
Right? Now, I'm not like a zoologist or anything. I don't know whether the story is really true or not.
Let me answer the question.
This is definitely getting into the book, though. I don't care.
Yeah. I was going to say, I'll answer the question. Not a shot, okay? You're talking about a 500-pound cat. And if you have any questions, YouTube sheer tiger power. Take a look at this tiger jumping out of a pool for its meal. Not a shot.
Wow.
Tigers like to fight, and that guy would have been dead. But I like the story. Unless the tiger was already dead and its tongue was sticking out. But tigers don't usually walk around with their tongues. They don't walk around with their tongues lollygagging about unless
That's
they're completely
amazing.
Retarded.
There's so much fun stuff to talk about. And, you know, the problem with sort of, if you pick up a 200-page, you know, introduction to the Mongols or something, there's like a few names, and it's just hard to sort of, it's hard to remember any of it because all of it's new to you and, you know, places you haven't been to or heard of or whatever. But if you get 2,000 pages and you've got sort of, you know, stories like this, I think of it as like, think of, you know, like you know, Lord of the Rings or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And this 1,000-page-long book with all these names and places that were made up, and people eat it up. They love it, right? I mean, the
sure.
only complaint about that is it's too short.
Well, you know, I will say, man, that the Mongols and Genghis Khan, in a lot of ways, there's still such an interest. I would say, arguably, that Genghis Khan is in the top three most fascinating historical figures for most people that don't read, most people that don't follow history. He's just so legendary. Everybody knows who he is. Everyone. You know, people know who Genghis Khan is. They knew who Napoleon was. They knew who Alexander the Great was.
Right.
But they, but Genghis Khan is, you know, I mean, who doesn't know who Genghis Khan is? I mean, so.
Yeah, he was on Star Trek.
Exactly. Exactly.
He's everywhere. He really is everywhere.
Yeah. Well, Ken, I can't thank you enough for you know, coming on this show. And, you know, it's always a learning process when we get people as smart as you are. And we thank you for that. What kind of law are you practicing in Hong Kong?
Doing securities law. So Chinese companies that are either listed in the United States or want to be listed in the United States. We do IPOs and we do a variety of offering.
Sure.
Like that, yeah.
All right. Well, maybe you could tell them to stop spying on us. get their own ideas. No.
Internal memo.
No. How is your Chinese? You speak it pretty well?
Speak it pretty well. Yeah.
Nice.
And
all right.
Just briefly, Ken. You know, in terms of writing this decade-long Mongol history, what languages are you thinking about? You know, learning or reading these original sources in?
Yeah. This really. I mean, the big five would be sort of Chinese, Persian, Arabic, Russian, and Latin, I think.
Oh, sure, the big five. The big five, Ken. While you're doing securities law, my God.
Yeah, the big five here sells tennis shoes.
Something tells me you don't smoke a lot of weed and just hang around. Something tells me you're not watching Breaking Bad every week.
Oh, I've missed so much good TV since coming out here.
Listen, when you watch Game of Thrones, it's the Dothraki are basically the Mongols, so I'm sure there'll be no surprises.
They're
for
stealing
you.
From Genghis.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the book is Firearms, A Global History to 1700, and it's actually pretty fascinating, man, and it got rave reviews from fellow historians. Ken Chase, thank you so much, man.
Thanks a lot, Brian. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, man. When you're in the States, let me know and come out to a show. I'd love to make you laugh as a thank you.
All right.
All right, bro.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
Thank
so
you.
Long.
See you later. Well, that's it, man. Another great podcast. I hope you guys learned something, and thank you to my partner in crime, Hunter Motz. Hunter Motz, the Dutchman with the tailpiece. That's what you got. Brendan Schaub calls you. He's like, he's got a tailpiece. The kid can squat 350 pounds, and he went to Harvard and speaks a lot of languages. And he gets us these amazing guests. Thank you, my friend.
My pleasure.
Really wild, huh?
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, all the horse blood stuff alone is enough to, like, blow your mind.
I know. Fucking horse blood. I swear to God.
Yeah.
It made me want to get on a fucking, buy a horse and just live off it. I want to see what my body looks like. Dude, what are you doing, man? You look so shredded. What are you eating? Blood.
Horse blood.
What am I eating? What am I drinking?
Yeah, especially if you just did it around Griffith Park. You just ride around Griffith Park living on the horse blood.
Yeah, but it'd have to be a mare so I could drink its milk during the summer. Bri, what's with that blood /
milk
horse
all over
milk?
Your face?
Yeah. Want to smell my breath? I feel like
they also used
up.
To ferment the mare's milk to make an alcoholic drink.
Oh, it must have been delicious. Their breath must have been great. Here come a bunch of fucking Mongols. How about getting raped? Oh, God. With somebody. Rape is horrifying enough, much less by a
Mongol
who smells like fucking blood
and fermented
mare's milk. Oh, they were such dicks. Fuck the Mongols. You guys stink and you're rapists. I wish I had a machine gun and a time machine.
Do you think they give extra time, like during sentencing, if it's a stinky rapist?
Well, they were such they had weird there was this superstition about killing like a ruler of a certain clan, so they would smother them in blankets because you didn't draw their blood. You could kill them, but you weren't supposed to draw the blood of royalty. So if you were the leader of a clan or leader of a, they would take you and essentially wrap you in a blanket until you fucking die. They'd smother you. Then there was something they called the slow death, where they would cut you And they start with your hands and your feet and just cut pieces off you very slowly mm-hmm. until you die. Hey, thanks a lot, Genghis Khan, for making the world a shitty place. Here's what I think of you. You're not a great general. I think you're a fucking sociopath with a bow and arrow. Go fuck yourself. But thanks so much for uniting the tribes, the milk-slash-blood-drinking tribes of the Gobi Desert, and ruining everything called civilization. We haven't bounced back yet, fuckhead. This is the Brian Callen show. This is the Brian Callen slash Hunter Mott show, I should say.
And we just lost our two listeners in Mongolia.
I know. I can't believe it. We were such a hit in Mongolia. Dude, nobody listens to you in the United States, but in Mongolia, they fucking love you.
Yeah, any bar that Brian goes into in Ulaanbaatar, there's always a glass of fermented mare's milk there for
exactly.
him.
Exactly. I can just see Ken Chase holding up his, like, dudes, I wrote, wait, don't overrun my town. I wrote a book about you guys. Firearms, the global history, never mind. You guys don't read.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. She stood